Hey everybody, I'm Scott. It's fundraising time again at antiwar.com. We need your help, and here's how you can help. Stop by antiwar.com/donate or call Angela Keaton, our development director, at 323-512-7095. That's 323-512-7095, or you can shoot her an email over to akeaton@antiwar.com.
Thank you very much for your support.
And welcome back. We're at Anti-War Radio for the Liberty Radio Network and for Chaos 95.9 and for antiwar.com. I'm Angela Keaton, and our next guest is Robert Dreyfuss of the Dreyfuss Report for the Nation. He's also the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. How are you doing there, Bob?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure.
Oh, and actually, the pleasure's all mine. I guess to start out with, I guess for the six people in the world who haven't seen that infamous magazine cover yet, if you could tell a little bit about your article about women and that cover in Afghanistan and kind of like dig through some of the propaganda we've been hearing.
You know, this is a very emotional and kind of heart-tugging issue because nobody, very few people, I guess, want women to be mistreated even individually, and certainly not as a population. And I felt, and I think many other people did, extremely manipulated by Time magazine putting out the picture of the woman whose nose and I guess ears had been sliced off by some maniacal person in Afghanistan who resented something about her behavior. Obviously, in any war, in any conflict, in any situation, you can put photographs of victims of all kinds on the cover of your magazine. If you put a picture of an American soldier wounded in Afghanistan, you're sending a political message, just as if you put a picture of a wounded Afghan child who was, you know, hurt in a U.S. missile attack on the cover, you're sending another kind of political message. And these things are very manipulative, and they don't really address either the serious underlying political causes of the war or really tell us much about what to do about it. And the fact is, and I think the reason why this is so manipulative, is that obviously all over the world, women are mistreated in many situations, from forced circumcisions, which happen over vast parts of Asia and Africa, to male-dominated cultures in which men are just routinely brutal toward women. I don't just mean the kind of domestic violence that you might find in the United States, but, you know, brutally mistreating women because they think it's their place in society. And so with the Taliban, it's even unclear whether the Taliban is the way it is because it emerged in this culture in which women are mistreated more broadly by non-Taliban Afghans and others in that part of the world, or whether the Taliban treats women the way it does because of its own ideological proclivities. It's kind of a chicken and egg problem, and obviously the answer is a little of both. But as I said, this photograph in Time magazine doesn't get us very close to understanding what we need to do in Afghanistan in a war that we're rapidly losing.
Well, let me ask this. I mean, the implication of the photograph is that this is what life is under the Taliban, yet weren't it family members who held her down and sliced an ear, part of an ear off and the nose off?
Well, you know, I don't really know about this specific case. I do think that's right from what I read, but I certainly haven't looked into it. The fact that family members did it doesn't tell us too much either, because they could have been doing it because they were ideologically committed to what the Taliban stands for, or because the Taliban made them do it, or who knows what other reasons. But these are social problems in a very backward and underdeveloped part of the world. It's possible, as I said, that the Taliban takes this further for ideological reasons, but it's also possible that the Taliban would act to discipline people who engage in this kind of violence, especially if it doesn't involve politics. In other words, I have no doubt that the Taliban would be ruthless in defending its political rule. But on the other hand, it's very possible that they would discipline and curb the kinds of excesses that happen for non-political reasons. That is, because, a woman doesn't like her husband or doesn't obey her husband or tries to run away or something like that. In fact, I believe that the Taliban, way back in 1994 when it got rolling, got its start specifically by cracking down on people who were involved in rapes. And won itself a reputation as bringing law and order to Afghanistan, which was then involved in a horrible civil war, in which there was a great deal of lawlessness and violence, even outside of the political context. So this is a terrible, terrible situation, and I think that what Americans have to understand, at least in my view, is that we can't go charging in there like a bunch of, moralistic lone rangers and try to fix a society that is going to take generations to evolve.
You said that some people were doing this in a well-meaning, some not so well-meaning in terms of the propaganda, the way the propaganda slant. But am I being cynical when I hear people on the right, in the U.S., on the right, discussing women's issues? I kind of feel, I guess I cringe or my eyes roll because I never hear these kind of pro-feminist, pro-women discussions in the domestic arena from the right in the U.S.
No, there's a huge amount of hypocrisy and I don't know if it's the case with Time magazine, but certainly with all of the conservative and right-wing and neoconservative supporters of the war, purely, opportunism to jump on the plight of this woman, Aisha, who was on the cover of Time magazine, and use that to defend their war policy. They're hardly champions of women's rights, although they have taken up that cause as part of their own crusade against political Islam and Islam generally, because in many of these countries, whether it's Iran or Saudi Arabia or elsewhere, women are horribly mistreated. On the other hand, it's ironic, I guess, that Iraq, which was the country that was there, enemy number one, just, 7 years ago, whatever you can say about Iraq, women in Iraq were highly advanced, were treated well, dressed in modern dress, went to universities, had senior positions all over society, and so if there was any country in the entire region from Pakistan to Morocco where you could point to women's advancement, it was Iraq. And now, of course, that country has plunged backward in terms of social issues, including the way it treats women, because so many of the current leaders of Iraq are ultra-conservative religious figures.
I guess because we're going to take a break here in a few moments for the next ad break, but I wanted to ask, you said, the promises of aid to Afghanistan as being, somewhat of a joke. I guess now that I hear the music, though, I guess we're going to pick this up as soon as we get back. It's Anti-War Radio, and we'll be back in just a moment.
You can watch the LRN Studio Cam and chat with other listeners anytime at cam.lrn.fm. That's cam.lrn.fm.
I'm about to have my nervous breakdown. My head really hurts. If I don't find a way out of here, I'm gonna go to surfers. I'm crazy and I'm hurt.
And we're back. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Angela Keaton. On the line with us today is Robert Dreyfus from the Dreyfus Report at The Nation. And you're asking, Bob, I basically, I guess I want to ask is there any hope for Afghanistan here? I mean, as long as the U.S. is there.
Well, you know, I don't know if there's hope for Afghanistan, whether we're there or not. It's an unbelievably poor country. It's been at war, basically, and the most horrible kind of grinding war for three solid decades now. You know, just to talk about hope for that country, really, you're talking about at least two entire generations that are going to have to grow up in a peaceful Afghanistan before it can be no longer traumatized. I do not think that there's much that the United States can do either to, you know, bring about stability in Afghanistan, if that's how they want to define victory these days, or to fix the deeper underlying problems. No, so I don't have any hope that certainly in the next year, 3 years, 5 years, that the United States can make that country look, you know, and feel any better than it is.
Why do you think we've been getting, the answer, I guess, is obvious, but I kind of feel like we've been getting the hard sell from the mainstream press and the White House on the glories of this war, particularly since WikiLeaks. And I do feel like there's like a push to sell us like, no, we're almost done, we're almost there.
Well, you know, there's a lot of politics behind this. I mean, leave aside the reality of what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan, which is, you know, not very impressive in terms of, you know, successes that have been achieved for this counterinsurgency strategy. If you look at it through the prism of domestic politics, the president has tried to split the difference by saying, I'm going to escalate the war but start a pullout next summer. And those two sort of contradictory impulses have drawn different responses from pro- and anti-war circles in this country. The pro-war circles say, we like the escalation, but this deadline is a terrible idea. And it seems like General Petraeus and the military, General McChrystal before him and so on, are lobbying, fighting, arguing that the deadline is a bad idea. So they seem to be casting in their lot with the pro-war crowd, of course. And those against the war, meaning at this point probably more than half to even two-thirds of Democrats, and a growing, you know, small but growing chunk of people who call themselves Republicans are, you know, turning against the war and don't like the escalation and think that Obama has to use this deadline as a way of starting to get us out. Now, obviously, he can move quicker than that. He could start to order a withdrawal, you know, next Tuesday. But I think right now, the best we're going to get from this kind of Hamlet-like White House is for them to reiterate this fall, this winter, when they get the review from the generals, that we're going to start pulling significant numbers of troops out next summer. And that's where Vice President Biden is. He said that explicitly, that it's going to be not just a token withdrawal, but a lot. He's certainly arguing that inside the White House, and there's a lot of people, I think, who agree with him from a military standpoint, and another big chunk of people who say, look, we can't afford this economically, and we can't afford this politically. We're going to lose our base, the Democratic base, which is running away from the war, and we're going to be stuck running for re-election in 2012 with, you know, Republicans supporting us on the war who aren't going to vote for us in a million years. So I think there's a political split developing, and so far Obama has been able to straddle it, but I don't think he can do that much longer. And he's got to make it clear, you know, which way he's going on this.
How much influence does Hillary Clinton have here?
Well, I mean, all the players have some influence. You know, the Secretary of Defense, Gates, who is one player, and Clinton, who's another, and you've got other lesser stars, you know, in the firmament. But this is really a White House that runs its own show. I mean, there is very little doubt in my mind that policy is made at the White House, at the National Security Council, and not by the State Department, the Defense Department, the intelligence agencies, other agencies. They get their marching orders from the White House, and so certainly there's political influence from all these people. I mean, they're not. It's not like they're disregarded, but I think it's the president and his immediate team, and General Jones and the people at the National Security Council, and on Vice President Biden's staff, who are making the decisions. And so, that's where the rubber really meets the road, I think, on not just Afghanistan, but all of foreign policy. I think all of foreign policy really comes, first of all, out of the White House. And I think that's why what happened with McChrystal when he gave those interviews to Rolling Stone is that he was basically looking at the White House and calling them wusses. And that's what led to his downfall, because the military thinks it doesn't have, and probably correctly, doesn't have the full support and confidence of the White House, which I think increasingly has to feel like they've been sold a bill of goods with this counterinsurgency policy, because they were told that this was going to deliver significant results if Obama ordered the escalation that he did. And so far, we just don't see those results. And not only that, it doesn't look like they're going to be achieved anytime soon.
Well, what would a good result look like to Obama? Like, what would he have been satisfied with?
Well, I mean, if, they had gone into the southern provinces, which were really the main target of the surge, and cleared out not just the leading, the capitals in those provinces, in Helmand and Kandahar, and perhaps some of the other smaller provinces further up along the Pakistan border, east of Kabul, and had been able to establish functioning governments with secure, capitals and spreading out into the districts around those capitals, then I think Obama could say, okay, we've gone into the heartland of the Taliban, and, we're extending the writ of the central government, and things are looking up. But that's just not happening. The offensive in Marja, which was part one of the surge, really accomplished nothing. They couldn't even stabilize a small town of some 60,000 people in a very rural kind of farming community. And the operation in Kandahar, which is the real prize, has really not even gotten off the ground, although it was supposed to have been launched in April, early May. They're now talking about patient, years-long nation-building efforts and village by village, valley by valley, taking of territory, which possibly could be done by the U.S. military if we gave them 10 years. I don't know. But there's just no way that they're going to get that 10 years, because politically and economically it can't be sustained for another 10 years. So I think that's the, if there's any hope that the president is going to get out of Afghanistan, it's going to be when he realizes that he can't look forward to the next, all 8 years, the next 6.5 years of his presidency being absorbed with a counterinsurgency nation building project on the other side of the globe. And that really all he has to do is to keep Americans safe from terrorist attacks, which is a much more manageable project.
Where do you think, I mean, you're saying that when Obama sees this, do you think, I mean, do you realistically, I mean, just in terms of like how physically possible it is it possible for everyone to be out of Afghanistan by next summer?
Oh, no, I don't think anybody thinks that. I mean, I guess it's physically possible. If I were president, I could probably get them out by then. No, we're talking about an Iraq-type process here. I mean, everybody thought Iraq was...
Thank you so much. I'm sorry, we're up against a hard break, and I'm still not really good at managing these yet. Thank you so much. That
was pleasure being on the show.
Oh, no, thank you.